Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of, March 29th of the House Subcommittee on Higher Education to order. Welcome, everyone. We have some bills to work, and we have a public hearing on some very interesting issues. We're going to be kind of jumping around on the agenda a bit, and we're going to start with House Bill 2117, which was carried over from last week, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2117. Anna, you want to tell us about this bill? Remind us of it.
Sure, just one moment, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2117 transfers function of the Office of Degree Authorization from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to the Oregon Department of Education. It creates a list of regionally accredited schools exempt from degree authorization process and establishes procedures for recommending additions to and subtractions from the list of approved colleges and for addressing complaints. This bill has an amendment that changes the listing of the schools in addition to some other changes regarding OSAC and the Office of Degree Authorization under OSAC.
Thank you, Anna. Well, let's get some more explanation of this bill. And to that end, I would call up Gary Andean, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Dimbrough. For the record, I'm Gary Andean, the president of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. Appreciate your having a second work session on this bill. It has been stripped down from, 14 pages to one in a dash four amendment now. This is a high priority bill for us because, remind you again, the U.S. Department of Education, in its zeal to get a better handle on all schools in the country and their use of federal funds, has said that every state must authorize all schools in its state if they choose to receive any kind of federal aid assistance for their students. So the wording was very specific in the U.S. Department's rules that were issued last fall, and it requires that the schools be authorized by name by a state agency. It's not good enough to just authorize a whole class of institutions. So at first we started off thinking we'd have to list all the schools by name in statute, at least those that were not chartered by the legislature in the 19th century. And as we talked more and more about that with the Office of Degree Authorization, it became apparent that rather than go through that process and then have to come back every session and update the list, it would be easier just to authorize that office to authorize these schools, and they could keep the list. I would just add one thing, and that is that we have an exceptional Office of Degree Authorization that serves three functions in Oregon. One is to protect the quality and the integrity of academic degrees by not allowing people to misuse bogus degrees that they've earned in the state. Another is to protect all the citizens of Oregon from diploma mills, and they do that very effectively. And the third is to manage a little-known statute called the Adverse Impact Statute that protects particularly private institutions from being overwhelmed by tax-subsidized public institutions that could put private school programs out of business just by offering less expensive programs that have been subsidized by the taxpayers. That statute is not used very often, but it's been very effective over the years in creating situations where the private and public schools in the state actually talk to one another before they launch new programs. With that, I will stop talking and let you go on with. I'm hoping passing the dash four amendments and moving it forward.
Great, thank you, Gary. Committee, any questions? Yes, Rep. Lindsay.
I don't know if it's appropriate for this portion or during work session, but I'm just I'm wondering who supports and who opposes the dash fours, and just because I'm having a hard time tracking exactly what the changes are. I always have
a lot of changes.
There's a lot of changes, and I'm usually the one that likes to see a nice red line. I don't even know if that's possible to get. Maybe I'm is there some way to, because I know there will be an A engrossed or a B engrossed once we do adopt amendments, but I wonder, is there some sort of way to get a better way to read and understand the amendments?
These should pass a law.
And this might be a question to the chairs.
Yeah, I would, Mr. Chair, I would just say it almost be easier if we had a bill that actually with these rather than, because this eliminates so much of what the original legislation, like you're saying, there's not a lot left. It'd be nice to see what is left.
Yeah.
And be able to look at that at a glance.
Gary.
The bill started out, I'm covering for Alan Contreras, who's not here today. The bill started out being a move of the Office of Degree Authorization to the Department of Education, the Oregon Department of Education. The more that they talked about that late last fall, the more it became apparent that the department did not want ODA. It became apparent that ODA might easily fall into this new Higher Education Coordinating Commission, Senate Bill 242 that we've all been talking about. And so that was the biggest part of this bill. That was all taken out. It said, we're not going to do that here. We're going to let ODA fall where it will in the 242 activities. There was another little piece that said the ODA administrator would report directly to the executive director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. She wanted that authority over him, and we decided that also would probably be handled in 242. So let's take that out of the bill. So it becomes just a very clean bill. All that's left is this issue with the U.S. Department of Education and their list of schools. That's what's been taken out of the bill.
Yes.
Maybe a specific question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Sure.
Who supports the Dash 4 amendments and who opposes the Dash 4 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsey, the Dash 4 amendments are supported by all the independent colleges in the state and all the degree-granting independent institutions. To my knowledge, there is no opposition. This is really is just a technical housekeeping kind of thing we need to get aligned with the U.S. Department of Education on.
Yeah, and let me just follow up. I think in its original form, the bill would have generated opposition. And, you know, this is one of those deals where, you know, the parties were trying to work out a prenuptial agreement, and in so doing, the marriage fell apart. So that became a non-issue. So all that we're left with, as Gary said, is really a technical fix that has to happen at this time.
So, because originally OSAC had opposed and sent a letter in opposition, but that is no longer the case. So this is a really easy, fun bill for us to.
Right.
Got it.
Takes away all these lines.
Perfect.
Great. Any other questions? Okay, Gary. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Great. So I'm going to close unless there's anyone else who'd like to speak to 2117. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2117, and I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2117. Rick Johnson.
Chair, I would move we adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 3/23/11 of House Bill 2117.
Great. Rep. Johnson has moved the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2117. Any discussion of the amendment? Any opposition to the amendment? Rep. Lindsey.
No opposition, but and maybe this will be a question I'll go ask Ramona on, but for future knowledge, being a freshman here, is there a way to read the amendments in their entirety somehow besides this way? And what I'm hoping is that my understanding is we will pass this Dash 4, likely pass it out of committee. There will be an A engrossed version which will allow us to then read it entirely. I'm just wondering if there is another way to help us consider amendments besides the bits and pieces explaining what was amended. Does anybody know?
Yeah, Anna, perhaps you could help us
with
that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lindsey, in the S-Drive, there is a hand-engrossed version of the Dash 3 amendment.
Hand-engrossed,
so committee staff prepares that for you when there is a complex amendment, and that's placed in the S-Drive. Part of the meeting materials for March 22nd, and so you can take a look at that. And so the difference basically between the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 is the removal of Section 6 on the Dash 3 amendment, which relates to the authority of OSAC over ODA in hiring. So that was the difference between the Dash 3 and the Dash 4.
Okay.
And, okay. So, and that makes sense, but that would be in the March 22nd meeting notes, Hand in Gross 3. We don't have a Hand in Gross number 4, and so it'd be better just for me to reach out to you.
Yes, that would be appropriate.
To ask for that.
Okay. Representative Boyle?
Is the reason that we don't have an engrossed version of the last amendment because we haven't voted on it to accept it, so therefore if an amendment hasn't been voted on to accept, if every amendment had to be engrossed before we voted on it, I think that may be an undue burden on the Legislative Council.
Okay.
That was in the form of a question.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes legislators do it themselves and share it, or you know, get their staff to do it and share it. But I think that's an excellent point. And you know, in the future, if any of you feel like you know you're looking at an amended bill or a bill that's potentially to be amended, and you really feel like you'd like to have some more clarity on it, just let us know, and we can put Anna to work. She's very good at it.
Good question.
Okay, so back to the vote on the amendment. Seeing no objection, the Dash 4 amendments are approved. Rep. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2117 with the Dash 4 amendments to the House Committee on Education with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Rep. Johnson has moved the House Bill 2117 as amended to the House Education Committee. Erica, you want to call the roll?
Aye.
Representative Hoyle?
Aye.
Representative Lindsey?
Aye.
Representative
Springer?
Aye.
And Co-Chair Deborah?
Aye. Okay, the House Bill 2117 has been approved, and we will send it up to the House Education Committee. So I will close the work session on House Bill 2117. Gary, thanks for your help with that. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3418 at this time. 3418, we thought we were going to work last week. It was carried over to today. I gave you some information about the amendments last week. This is the bill on... that would create the task force to develop the performance metrics and potentially performance-based funding for colleges and universities in the state. And we have the amendments have to do with the date. Because this needed to be lined up with the implementation of the transition of OUS from being a state agency to being a public university system in July 1st of 2012, we needed to get these in place in time for the next legislative session in February of 2012. So the effective date was changed. Also, there were some additions to the task force. We added a faculty member from, well, we made it so that there would be a faculty member from both a regional and a research university, and also a student from a regional and a research university, because the metrics are going to be different for those entities. And then we decided, you know, it probably would make sense to have a couple of presidents on this panel. And so we added a community college president and a university president. So those are the amendments. And be happy to entertain a motion to adopt the amendments. Rep. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, there's one other language change.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Correct. And there's one other language change, and it's on the flip side under J. In the original bill, it talked about somebody from a labor union. I don't know if you remember. We had a discussion around that, and it was a little misleading. You know, the intent was we're talking about a a non-faculty staff person, and we got lost in Ledge Council speak there. So we've clarified that this is what we're talking about, a non-faculty staff member at a state institution of higher ed. So with that, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments for House Bill 3418, dated 3/22/11.
Rep. Johnson has moved adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to 3418. Any discussion? Okay, then is there any disagreement with the amendment? Okay, seeing none, the Dash 3 amendments are approved. Rep. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3418 with the Dash 3 amendments approved and passed to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Johnson moves that House Bill 3418, as amended, be moved to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Erica, you want to call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative
Hoyle?
Aye.
Representative
Lindsey?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Oh, yes.
I'm here.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay, House Bill 3418 passes, and it will go to the House Committee on Education. Thank you. Okay, now, so I'll close the work session on House Bill 3418, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2021. This is the first of the bills related to career schools, and this is the one that has to do with fees. Right. Anna, you want to just walk us through that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2021 authorizes the State Board of Education to collect non-refundable licensing fees for administration of licensing programs for career schools. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2011. This bill has a revenue statement as well as a fiscal impact statement.
And it will go to the Ways and Means Committee, mm-hmm. Right? Okay. You all should have received or maybe seen on the shared drive, we got a letter of support for this from the Career College Association. They're in support of this fee increase. So I guess we're ready for a motion, then we can see if there's any debate.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2021 without recommendation as to passage to the House Committee on Education.
Okay, Rep. Johnson moves without recommendation House Bill 2021 to the full Education Committee. Discussion.
So moving without recommendation to the higher.
Yeah. Okay. It's just a neutral position move. It has to go to Ways and Means anyway.
Yeah.
Ultimately, and that discussion happened there.
Okay. Well, I was initially opposed to it. Just reading the, Mr. Chair, Section 2 says the State Board of Education may adopt, makes it permissible to adopt by rule if they so choose, fees for teacher registrations, copies of student transcripts, submissions of applications, submissions of payments, a lot of fees that the Department of Education can adopt at their own choice. So I was going to be no on a due pass recommendation, especially when we're asking for cheaper books for students and many other fees. So as for move without opinion, essentially, let me think on that because I'm trying to, I'd like to, is there some way I can put some sort of explanation of my vote?
Certainly you can communicate that to the communicate it to me, okay. And I can share it with the Education Committee. I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, and you know, I think that the ODE can develop the rules, but increases still have to be approved by Ways and Means, don't they? Or is
well, the statute specifically says we're giving them, I mean, it says State Board of Education may adopt by rule fees. I mean, that's very permissible language. And I just go by what the statute says.
Yeah, Rep. Springer.
If I may just add a little something there, not a lot. I completely agree with you, Representative Lindsay. The only caveat to that, and I can't speak clearly to it, is that there are some limitations in statute. I can't tell you what those are right now. But there are some limitations there. But I think there is a great deal. I share your concern. I'm not necessarily in support of this bill. I will, with no recommendation, pass it on down to Ways and Means. But I'm, in essence, I'm not in support of it. But there is a ceiling out there for different fee structures.
And I appreciate your comments, too, Rep. Lindsay. And the only way that I would be able to move it out is without a do pass, if you will, or without a recommendation to let them make their case at that other level in the process.
And just to reiterate, and we did receive a letter of support from the groups that would see their fees increase, you know, under this. You know, I think it's going to be incumbent upon the colleges to make that case before the Ways and Means Committee. You know, I think the intent here is that that there's a sense that there needs to be some better oversight to protect the integrity of the industry, to make sure that they're not bad apples, you know, if I can put it that way. So there is an interest within the industry, I think, for these fee increases. But I would say that, you know, for it to be compelling before the Ways and Means Subcommittee, it's going to, you know, take some testimony. Further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, Erica, you want to call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Hoyle?
Aye.
Representative Lindsay?
Aye. And can I put it on record now? Or is that prior? Aye.
Yes.
Sorry?
I think our concerns have been noted,
sure.
And we'll pass it
aye.
On.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Denver?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2021 is approved without recommendation and will be sent in that manner to the Committee on Education. So I'll close the work session on 2021, and I will open a work session on 2022. 2022 has some amendments, and I'm going to, with your indulgence, call up Teresa Green and Autumn Wilburn to explain those amendments to us. Thank you.
Co-Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, thank you for having us in front of you today to walk you through the Dash Ones to House Bill 2022. I'm glad that I have a short amendment to walk you through.
And you are?
Sorry, thank you. For the record, Autumn Wilburn, Oregon Department of Education, with me today. I also have Teresa Green from the Oregon Department of Education. The Dash One Amendment to House Bill 2022 simply deletes a redundant, confusing sentence beginning on line 18 after the period with the word A, licensee, all the way through the period on line 20. Removes the entire sentence. We heard commentary in this committee and also from our stakeholders that this sentence was redundant and confusing, and so we accommodated that with this amendment to remove it.
Thank you, Autumn. Teresa, anything to add to that?
Nothing.
Okay. Committee, questions? Any questions about the amendments?
Amendment is clear.
No?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2022, dated 3/17/11.
Okay. Rep. Johnson has moved approval of the amendments to House Bill 2022. Any further discussion? Any objection to adoption? Okay. These amendments are approved. Rep. Johnson, you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do move. I move House Bill
2022 to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Rep. Johnson moves House Bill 2022 as amended to the House Committee on Education. Discussion of this bill.
I'm going to leave also.
I'm going to get Sean. He just outside.
Any discussion of House Bill 2022 as amended? Okay, seeing none, Erica, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Hooker? Aye. Representative Hoyle? Aye. Representative Quayle? Aye. Representative Lindsey? Aye. Representative Springer? Aye. Representative Johnson? Aye. Representative Negro? Aye.
House Bill 2022 has been approved and will go to the House Committee on Education. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2022. You also have House Bill 2024 on the docket, but some amendments are being prepared for that, and so I'm carrying it over until Thursday. Okay. So I am now going to open a public hearing on House Bills 3118 and 3320. I'm going to open those up simultaneously. These bills are both have to do with the condition, the use of part-time faculty at our state's community colleges and universities. As many of you know, the colleges and universities have been making increasing use of part-time faculty as part of their effort to meet the increasing demand for higher education. At the same time, the revenues, the funding of higher education that has not kept pace, and that has created some stresses to the system. House Bill 3118 is following up on a bill that we passed in 2009, that was House Bill 2557, which one of whose requirements had a reporting requirement from CCWD and OUS to let us know about, you know, what the hiring patterns were, the number of students who were being taught by full-time faculty versus part-time faculty, what the differential pay rates were for the groups. And those, the first of such reports was sent to us back in October, and I think I emailed those to you last night for your perusal. House Bill 3118, you know, mainly has some technical fixes to that in terms of how the reporting happens, and you know, just to make it as clear as possible for people what the usage is. It also has another provision, and that is it's asking the colleges and the universities to report on the level of access or the ways that students have access to their instructors outside of class. During the hearings in 2009, that surfaced as a problem that students were having when their instructors were part-time faculty, and so we want to get a sense from the colleges and universities how they were handling that situation. And so I think you'll hear some testimony about around that issue. House Bill 3320 has to do with unemployment insurance, and it has to do with a very interesting wrinkle in our federal unemployment law, which has it that it says that educational employees are not eligible for unemployment benefits in periods between terms or between academic years. and traditionally between academic years has been interpreted to mean to be summer. And that harkens back to the original development of the unemployment law, which was really for K-12. And it, you know, in most K-12 institutions really are essentially shut down during the summer. And in earlier days, the same was true for many colleges, if not most colleges and universities. We're in a different time now as far as colleges and universities, and most colleges have run significant programs during the summer. And yet, the part-time faculty who otherwise would teach during the summer, if they lose their employment, then they are cut off from unemployment benefits during that time. And so House Bill 3320 is an attempt to deal with that problem. I think you're going to hear some testimony about the problem, and then I'll at the end, I'll brief you on how our conversations are going with the Department of Labor, which, not surprisingly to many of you, are challenging. So with that, I'm going to call up Rob Wagner to kick this off. And
pull up a panel?
Sure. Rob Wagner, David Reeves, and Candia Elliott. Welcome to your House Committee on Higher Education.
Thank you.
Mr. Wagner.
Thanks for the introduction and stealing everything that I was going to say about the bill. Chair Dembrough, Chair Johnson, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Wagner. I'm the Director of Political and Legislative Affairs for the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of both House Bills 3320 and 3118. For those that know, AFT members include faculty, adjunct faculty, graduate teachers at the university level and throughout community colleges, through a lot of our community colleges throughout the state. And both House Bills 3320 and 3118 are elements of an effort that was launched 6 years ago nationally called the Faculty and College Excellence, or FACE, campaign. And you'll see members and the audience out there wearing buttons that say FACE on them right now. And the FACE campaign was really addressed on focusing on two goals. And one was the restoration after this 30-year trend of more away from full-time tenure track faculty toward the use of contingent, adjunct, part-time faculty, toward hiring more people who are able to teach full-time in our community colleges and universities. And the second element is looking at equitable treatment for those adjuncts. And so if you see the red faces on the faculty that were running down from the committee, they were down in the Senate Education Committee testifying on another FACE-related bill at the exact same time, looking at job reliability. So I'll keep my comments limited because we have firsthand accounts from our members here today about their experiences, and they can talk in depth about what's going on. But I will say that you sometimes heard these terms, freeway flyers, who are faculty that teach at multiple institutions and fly around to campus. Sometimes we have members that teach at upwards of five or six campuses in one term, or we call them road scholars, so who drive from campus to campus. And they're ultimately very focused on the educational success of the students that they teach. Representative Dembrough mentioned, last session, House Bill 2557 passed the legislature with overwhelming majorities. I think it went 55-1 in the House and 30-0 in the Senate. And it adopted the principles of the FACE campaign. And I should have given this to Erica. This is my testimony. And attached to my testimony is a copy of the bill, and you can see the principles that were adopted by the legislature last session. So, and the it also addressed treatment of adjuncts in terms of being able to access more affordable health insurance benefits, which is a huge issue for them and their families as well. And in addressing this reporting requirement, 3118 is an extension of that effort by improving the reporting requirements in House Bill 2557, including that critical element of determining educational quality by assessing opportunities that students have to faculty outside of the classroom. My last comment will be on House Bill 3320, which addresses the nature of contingent faculty employment from a little different angle. Currently, as Representative Dembrough mentioned, there are faculty members who teach summer sections year after year, and you're going to hear their stories today. And yet, due to the current interpretation of employment law, they're classified alongside K-12 teachers, and if they lose their summer sections that they've been teaching year after year after year, and they're actively seeking a job, they're unable to access unemployment insurance. And it is important to note that this is not a special benefit, nor are they seeking wage supplement program. They are truly dependent on these assignments every term to provide for their families. So the final thing I'll say is our members are not wedded to the language in either bill, and we certainly don't want to risk putting Oregon out of compliance with the Department of Labor. However, both the states of California and Washington have language which allow part-time faculty to access unemployment insurance. And if they're laid off during summer session, their way to find, we're just looking for the same equitable treatment here in Oregon. So with that, I will turn my attention over to the distinguished panel I have with me. Thanks for your attention and time.
Thank you, Rob.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here today. My name is David Reeves. I'm president of the American Federation of Teachers Oregon. AFT represents thousands of workers in schools, community colleges, and higher education throughout the state. I'm also adjunct faculty at Portland Community College. Taught there for 15 years, every term for 15 years. Today I'm offering testimony in support of House Bill 3318 for accurate reporting of teacher staffing and student access, and HB 3320 to prevent the denial of unemployment compensation for summer term assignments. I'll just give a little background, kind of expand on what Mr. Wagner already said. The number of temporary contingent positions in post-secondary teaching is a problem that's really arisen over the last two decades. And we're very pleased to see that Oregon, particularly the House and the Senate with joint committees and the individual committees, is taking student success seriously. And that's why we can't ignore what's going on in instructional staffing at our colleges. And I think HB 3118 will help give a picture on exactly what is the staffing situation in colleges and universities throughout the state. As you know, Oregon has the goal of 40-40-20, which means that 80% of all Oregonians will have earned a college or university certificate or diploma by 2025. Now that we're focused on the need for quality education to meet the demands of the 21st century, we really have to look at these kinds of bills that really do focus on the quality of education. The number of adjunct teaching and faculty teaching at community colleges has risen tremendously, as I said. For example, at Portland Community College, adjunct faculty teach 65% of the classes. In the face of decreasing funding, college administrators have more and more relied on low-paid, temporary, contingent faculty. I'm not referring to the occasional academic or professional who moonlights to teach a class. I'm talking about these adjunct positions as filled by career teachers. If you look at the programs at the community colleges, you'll find the largest number of adjunct teachers are not in trades or professions. They're in departments like English, developmental education, English as a second language, math. Those are the departments that have the largest number of adjunct contingent teachers. And, you know, some industries operate with a high percentage of temp workers constantly churning over. I don't think these are necessarily businesses we associate with high quality, nor are they working conditions that lead to student retention and success. And I think at this time that Oregon is seriously looking at our system of post-secondary education. There's proposals for coordinating commissions, better ways to structure higher ed in the state. We really do need accurate, up-to-date figures on who is teaching our students in our colleges and universities. The data that HB 3118 calls for example, the ratio of contingent to regular instructors, and how students have access to their instructors will inform us in our any new commissions, boards, any studies that are done as we are really looking for innovations in our post-secondary education system. Shall I go on to 3320?
Please.
Is that okay? Okay. Yes, in support of House Bill 3320 to prevent the denial of unemployment compensation for summer term assignments. I think what we see is the traditional school year, 9 months with summer terms off, has really changed in this modern world. As I said myself, I've taught 15 years, four terms a year. It's just the way classes are scheduled. It's the way the college runs at Portland Community College. The traditional full-time student who completed a bachelor degree in 4 years is not what we are seeing anymore. Many students work full or part-time jobs. They take care of family members. They have other obligations. Many are returning from the workforce, or they're still in the workforce, and they're trying to upgrade their skills to meet demands of a changing workforce. So we're seeing a lot of students studying all four terms of the year. Summer is not a vacation or a break time. And as I've said before, the system of employment for instructors has also changed. Many of the instructors are now adjunct contingent. They don't have a 9-month work year. They don't have an annual contract or salary. They also rely on teaching four terms a year. For these teachers, summer term's not an extra perk. It's an essential one quarter of their income and of their workload. You know, our existing legislation refers to employees having a reasonable assurance of being reemployed in the fall term. Contingent faculty do not have any reasonable assurance, and that's what we really want recognized in this legislation. You know, it's really not usual to lose assignments for a term, but it does happen occasionally. Like I said, I've taught 15 years every term. I've never lost an assignment. It's just those few cases where it does happen, the way the existing law treats it and policy of the Employment Department treats it, I think is rather absurd. You know, instructors should be eligible for the same assistance in available to other job seekers when they lose employment, regardless of what time of the year it is. You know, it's unreasonable to deny access to unemployment assistance for one out of four terms each year. As Mr. Wagner said, California and Washington offer access to unemployment compensation in summer terms for adjunct faculty, faculty that, as I said, do not have reasonable assurance of employment and really do have their employment contingent upon enrollment, funding, programmatic changes. That's what we're really looking to recognize, is that it's no longer the traditional 9-month year for the majority of our adjunct instructors who are career teachers who teach four terms a year. So I urge you to support House Bill 3320.
Thank you, David.
Good afternoon. My name is Candia Elliott, and I'm a part-time instructor at PCC. I've been a part-time teacher there since 1991. I want to speak just briefly to the fact that in my teaching career, I've actually taught at four different higher education institutions: Portland State, PCC, University of New Mexico, and Western Oregon State College. And that's pertinent because over the time that I've taught in those institutions, which has been since the 1980s, I have, as my colleagues have said, really seen the character of our students change. The most traditional university that I taught at was the University of New Mexico, which is a four-year school, which you might think is like a traditional college. And I was teaching freshman and sophomore classes there. Half of the students in my classes were over the age of 25. 95% of them had families and jobs in addition to their college work. And this isn't a traditional type four-year school. So the students that we have at Portland Community College are going to school year-round, working year-round, and need continuity with their teachers and so on year-round. I just want to relate my experience with unemployment. In addition to teaching part-time from 2009 to from 2008 to 2010, I worked full-time doing admissions for 5 allied health programs. And this is during the time that our enrollment and our applications were going through the roof. So we had easily 4 times the number of applications that we'd usually had in those programs before. So our workload was very, very high. The process of getting into those programs is quite complex, although it should seem simple if you have the prerequisites and so on. It's much more complex than you would believe. So I worked in that job for those 2 years and then was laid off at the end of that period of time. And during the first summer that I was laid off, I had no problem with unemployment. Well, actually, I did have some problems with them, but I was able to get unemployment during that summer term. And I should also mention that in that full-time position, I did not have summers off, nor do I in my teaching position. As a matter of fact, I've taught every summer since 2006. But I worked during school breaks, spring term, winter term, fall breaks, and in fact the summer is one of our busiest times because we get in a lot of applications and a lot of processing of programs that start in the fall. So I was able to get unemployment for the summer of 2009. I was very actively searching for a job all during this time. At the beginning of the summer of 2010, the unemployment office told me that I could not get unemployment for summer because I worked for an educational institution and that was a normal break. Now, as I said, in neither the full-time admissions position or in my teaching position since 2006 have I had a summer off. So it seems the way they apply this is somewhat inconsistent. And again, I think, as my colleagues have said, it's based on this antiquated notion that schools operate 9 months a year. And that may be true for K through 12. It is certainly not true for higher education anymore.
Okay, thank you, Kendia. And colleagues, let me just say that you know, as I indicated in the introduction, you know, the real crux of this unemployment issue has to do with how the academic year is defined and, you know, changes in the, you know, the way that instruction is happening in higher education. And that's, we're looking at the way that the state of Washington has addressed this, which is to, the state of Washington distinguishes between schools that are considered year-round schools, 12-month schools, and those that are 9-month schools. And it has to do with the percentage of their courses that are taught during the summer. The way they do it, if 30%, if during the summer the number of courses that are taught are at least 30% of what they would do, what they would be in one of the other terms, then they're considered, that's considered a regular term. If not, if they're offering fewer than 30% of the, you know, normal load of classes, then they're not. This is a model that, you know, we feel has merit. I mean, I feel has merit. And we're working with the Oregon Employment Division, which has been, we've had very good conversations with them. Earlier, when you heard me perhaps registering some frustration, it's with the Federal Department of Labor, which I think is being a little inflexible here. But that is something that we're continuing to work on, to try to get a definition of the summer, which is really consistent with the actual practice. And that's the goal of this bill. But at the same time, you know, as Rob mentioned, or David mentioned, this is really, the intent is focused on those teachers who teach regularly during the summer and who then lose their work during the summer. It's really not geared towards teachers who never teach during the summer, but, you know, who claim, well, I could have gotten an assignment but didn't, and so I deserve unemployment. So, you know, the effort, the intent of the bill is to try to limit the universe, you know, so that it becomes more manageable for the colleges and the universities. So I just wanted to explain that. So any questions of this panel?
We have some folks from the community colleges that will actually talk about this later. I'll have some questions for them, I think, that are probably more technical. But okay. I guess just for my own comments I would make is that it's difficult for me to wrap my mind around this as a private sector guy, as somebody who hasn't had access to unemployment insurance. I'm a self-employed guy, so I'm trying to get there and trying to understand where you're coming from, but I just want to say from the outset it's kind of a stretch for me personally, but I want to keep my mind open, and I'll ask some questions of our community college folks.
Great. Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, you just brought up a point that I've just been kind of wrestling with a little bit, so I don't know, maybe you can address it or somebody on the panel. What are the safeguards for that person who, because I certainly know the class load is not as heavy in the summer as it is in the fall, winter, and spring, because we get the catalog, we're one of those few families, when we get Lynn Benton Community College's catalog, we have to sit down, look at it, and read it. All of us, including the 13-year-old, see if there's something interesting, and sometimes take classes. And it's just physically smaller in the summertime, it absolutely is. So what about those instructors where it's an option to figure out who's going to do what? Will there be that latitude in place for somebody to say, you know what, skip me this time, not going to teach a class or two this time, and draw the unemployment? Because I'm just confident you don't have the same amount of teachers in the spring as you do the summer as you do the fall.
Anybody want to answer that?
Well, I think as Representative Dembro said, like in Washington, they have the differentiation between colleges that are year-round and those that aren't. So I can say it. A place like Portland Community College, that catalog is not appreciably thinner in the summer. That students really are studying four terms a year at many colleges. It's also our intent in this legislation is to cover those instructors who rely on four terms a year. And if it's up to the committee to amend the language to make that clear, that's fine with us. But that's really what we're talking about. I mean, and maybe Representative Johnson, for somebody like me, I don't look forward to what if I were unemployed and having to live on unemployment while I was trying to seek other employment. It's not, I don't think it's something that's really an incentive for most people to go on, particularly those that are professionals in teaching at community college. So that's not our intent at all. It's just something, if somebody's been relying on something for years and years, it's just a little assistance to do while they are looking for a job. And as you know, the Department of Employment requires you to be seeking employment while you're getting unemployment. It's not intended to be for somebody that turns down an assignment. It's intended to be somebody that got an assignment previous summer and is relying on that, has proven that they are counting on assignments four times a year in programs that are open four times a year. So that's our intent.
Thank you. Yeah, and I would just add that although the catalog is going to be a little thinner during the summer, the odds are that all or nearly all of the courses that will be taught in that catalog are being taught by part-time faculty, because there is still a tendency, this is changing somewhat, but there's still a tendency for full-time faculty to be teaching fall, winter, and spring, and then the summer classes are carried by the part-time faculty. So this really is an issue for part-time faculty, I think. Yes, Rep. Springer.
Well, I think I have a question here. I've been struggling with my computer this entire meeting, so I apologize for not having it in front of me. So would this apply to those instructors, the instructor you just described, that teaches full-time fall, winter, spring, and then does not teach in the summer?
No. Summer work for a full-timer would be considered overtime. you know, an overload, and okay. So it would not apply to them.
That follow up. That's based on contract language. What stipulates that that is a fact? Is it contract language or something else?
I believe. May I?
Yeah.
Because it's a 9-month assignment for full-time faculty. That's the understanding. It's a 9-month. The annual assignment is 9 months. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Part-time faculty is term to term. There's not anything longer than a 3-month term.
Right.
So this would not apply to
it would not, because they're not laid off during the summer, right? They're just not getting overtime. And I believe that according to employment law, not getting overtime doesn't qualify you for unemployment benefits.
So.
Right. Rick Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, am a private sector guy and am self-employed, and I don't have the luxury of collecting unemployment, so far as I know. I've never been forced to try to tap into it. But we have hit downturns a time or two over the 18 years, and we have had to lay people off, and I was happy that the employees had opportunities to collect unemployment to see them through to their next gig. So I don't have a problem with that. It's been educational, no pun intended, for me to hear about the changes in study patterns at these different schools. You know, obviously, it's been a while since I went, and things do seem to have changed a bit. I am glad that you're looking at other states and what they're doing. I admit I'm a little surprised by the 30% cutoff. It was lower than the number I was expecting to hear, and I was thinking half, 50%. But you're referencing Washington State, and I heard California mentioned before. Is that 30% fairly standard across other states?
I don't believe that California. I think Washington is it's the only state that we know of, at least in the region, that uses this methodology. And so California does not do that. California, because of court cases that they've had and the way that they're interpreting the federal law, and at least so far are getting away with it, they deem part-timers who fall into this category in all schools to be eligible for unemployment.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to go on record that I do know that spring comes after winter, and apparently I said that wrong thanks to a note that was graciously passed to me by Representative Harker, and so maybe next time that catalog comes, I should sign up for a class.
Rep. Harker, thank you for your vigilance and really maintaining the standards of this committee. Okay, any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call up Rosemary Teeter now.
I was thinking, too.
And before Rosemary begins, Rosemary, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Members to my right who were on the Education Committee 2 years ago might remember you as the lady with the pills who came in with your prescription.
Who addressed you in French first, because one of the discussions was foreign languages in schools. I don't have my testimony in French today.
Thank you, Rosemary.
Co-Chair Denbrough, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Rosemary Teeter. I've been an adjunct instructor at Clackamas Community College for the past 10 years, teaching primarily GED and adult basic education. Right now, my students are in the middle of math. For the last 6 years, it has been my privilege and honor to represent between 300 and 400 adjunct faculty members as the president of the CCC Part-Time Faculty Association. So I come before you today to speak in favor of House Bill 3118 and House Bill 3320, and I'll address them together. The ranks of adjunct faculty contain instructors teaching for a variety of reasons. Administrators of community colleges will have you believe that the majority work to supplement an existing full-time job or to give back to the community, and that having unemployment benefits during the summer doesn't matter. They would also have you believe that having to pay unemployment benefits to part-timers, as described in this bill, during the summer would bankrupt them. Neither is true. David referred to the past 20, 25 years, how the practice of employing adjuncts has gone from the occasional adjunct to meet a sudden surge in enrollment, which required an extra instructor or two, to the primary way that colleges deliver classes to students today. As this practice has changed, the ranks of adjuncts have swelled commensurately, and the predominant reason which adjuncts give for working as adjuncts is to support themselves and their family, career instructors. I would love to be able to say to you that we make so much money as adjuncts that we can save enough money during the traditional nine-month school year to carry us through the four-month period between the end of spring term and the first paycheck of fall if a class we had counted on is canceled. But most of us don't. Most of us make between one-half and two-thirds of what full-time faculty make for the same work. Many of us work at two, three, or four different colleges attempting to cobble together a living. Administrators of community colleges will tell you it's not the same work, and they'll give you numerous serpentine explanations as to why not, but it is the same work. They also tell you it's impossible to calculate equivalent pay between part-time instructors and full-time instructors. It's not. The members of the Clackamas Community College Part-Time Association, Faculty Association bargaining team have done it twice. We'd be happy to share the methodology with anyone on the subcommittee who would like to have it so that you can have an apples-to-apples comparison. And yes, we wait 4 months for our paychecks. This isn't new math. It's the reality. We usually get our final spring term check at the end of June, and we don't get another check until the end of October. Fall term has been underway, and we've been working for between 5 and 6 weeks by the time we get that first check. The colleges justify this by claiming that they can't be certain we'll show up for our assignments because we're part-time and subject to leaving on a whim. About 300 part-time faculty, approximately 60 of those people have been there in excess of 10 years. And some of us, 30 years. So we hardly seem whimsical about our employment, especially when we're feeding our families and making sure that we survive. Oh, and the full-time faculty, they get their first paycheck of fall term at the end of September. To be able to collect unemployment benefits during the summer, when the number of classes offered to students is severely reduced and an assignment has been taken away that was counted on, will allow part-time instructors to continue to support themselves and their families while they wait through the 4 months of summer for the first full-time paycheck. By no means will those instructors live lavishly or high off the hog on these unemployment benefits, but they'll be able to get through. The colleges want to play it both ways regarding reasonable assurance that the instructor will perform services for the same college again. The Human Resource Department sends out notices during spring term, at the end of spring term, which we are expected to sign and return promptly, stating that we plan to work for the college again in the fall, but that no guarantees of subsequent employment are made or implied, even though we may have an assignment for which they expect us to show up, and the college schedule for fall may list our names as instructors on certain classes. Either there is or there isn't an assignment, and this has been in flux for a long time. It can't continue to be both ways. This bill will not change the college's attempts to have it both ways, but it will give hardworking adjuncts a fighting chance to survive in their chosen line of work. It will even the playing field at a little time when so many adjuncts have thankless uphill battles to survive on a term-by-term basis so that they can provide high-quality instruction for our students. And we really do work term to term. I have not yet signed, contracts for spring term, even though the term has started. And that's the way it goes. I applaud the efforts of the sponsors of this bill and the folks behind the scenes who have done the research and had the preliminary conversations which paved the way for the bill to be bills to be introduced. Thank you for your time. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Rosemary. Committee, any questions for Ms. Teeter?
One question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Rosemary, how many summers, if you will, have you experienced this situation in your own career?
Of having a class promised and then canceled?
Or, yeah.
Possible and then canceled, but never definite. Definite doesn't happen until you've actually started teaching the class. Things are uncertain until you begin. They can even be uncertain after you begin teaching the class, because during the first 2 weeks, if you don't get enrollment, the class can be canceled. So there have been promised but not provided, but never canceled once it started. One of the reasons I ended up being a freeway flyer early on is that there weren't any classes available for me in the summertime at Clackamas. So I went to the women's prison in Wilsonville twice or three times a week to teach, and that got me through. And I was subbing for people at that point. It was not even a normal term assignment. I was simply subbing for folks who were out. The difficulty in understanding what this looks like from the private sector side, if you work with a temp agency, you deal with the temp agency. You don't necessarily deal with the individuals who want to count on a job but can't because they're being employed by a temp agency. It's very much like that. We want to count on being able to work in the summertime because for most of us, we need to. The reality of it is fewer classes in the summer. If a class doesn't make enrollment, and that this bill speaks particularly to that kind of situation, if a class doesn't make enrollment, it can be yanked up to 2 weeks into the course. The class will be canceled, the student's assigned to other classes, but the instructor is dangling. And that's why being able to apply for unemployment benefits is so important. Did I answer your question?
It helps. Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming down, Rosemary.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
It's good to see you.
Yep. Great. Okay, now it's time for Karen Smith and Jerry Donnelly. Karen from OCCA. You've all met before. Jerry Donnelly, if you find me treating him with great respect and deference, it's not only because he's a constituent. But he's someone I've worked with for many years. Karen, did you want to start?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Smith. I'm the general counsel of the Oregon Community College Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I thought I'd just start out quickly with House Bill 3118, and then give a few brief comments in 3320, and then turn it over to Jerry, if that's all right. The report that was published in October of this year's last year came out of House Bill 2557 that was passed during last session, and Oregon's community colleges have every intention of fully complying with the requirements in that report. We did, when we submitted the report in October, realize that there were a lot of inconsistencies in it because we didn't have standard criteria that were used by all 17 colleges because we're not a system. There were some differences in how that information was reported. When we realized that, we worked with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to pull together a work group that included instructional administrators, HR, human resources directors, business managers, our institutional researchers, and our business officers to come together and try to develop some consistent criteria so that the information that was provided and the data that was submitted to CCWD would be consistent across the state. We did that. We had a lot of discussions that were taken out to all of the various constituencies among those groups for comment, and we had a really great process with lots of discussion that resulted in some standard criteria that then every college used to rerun their data, and those were submitted in a revised report that was submitted in December by the department. In the course of that, we've been working with Representative Dembro to address some questions that he had about how those data calculations were made. I believe we are making progress on resolving some of those questions, and I think Jerry will talk about that in a minute. But we do believe that we have resolved and are working towards resolving those issues so that we will not need this bill and that we will continue to report as we are required under House Bill 2557. It's an annual report that's due every October. And then just briefly on House Bill 3320, the Oregon Community College Association opposes this bill for both policy and fiscal reasons. This issue has been debated a number of times over the years about the appropriateness of providing unemployment benefits for community college faculty during this summer. And the changes that are proposed in the bill as it's currently drafted actually are much broader and go beyond contingent faculty, and the changes in the presumption for reasonable assurance goes far beyond what has been explained as the intent of the legislation. I wanted to point that out. And I also wanted to comment that I did take a look at our enrollment numbers this morning to see, you know, what is the trend. And actually, it's fairly consistent. We look back to 2006, and I looked at summer, fall, winter, spring, and summer term tends to have a significant drop in enrollment. It's about a quarter to a third of what it is in the other terms of the academic year. And we'd be happy to provide that information to you if you'd like to see that further. And then I would like to turn it over to Jerry.
Okay, just before you do, Jerry, Karen, so yes, it would be great if you could provide that data. Is it disaggregated according to institutions?
It is, yes.
And is there a variation among the institutions in terms of what they're offering during the summer?
I was just looking at the FTE that was reported during those terms. It is fairly consistent when a proportional drop, the smaller the college, obviously, the smaller number of courses or students that they're serving in the summer. The larger institutions, I'd say, were consistently about a third of what they were during the other terms of the year.
Okay. Thank you. Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, and you said without a whole lot of detail that you believe that the scope of this bill is much broader than maybe what we understand. Could you expand on that a little bit? Who would be covered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, I was actually going to let Jerry delve into the detail of that, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Great. And Rep. Parker, do you want to hold your question, or did you, was this?
You tell me.
Well, I don't know what it is.
I'm going to ask it then, so you'll know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, you mentioned that this has been considered over the years numerous times. Do you think that the changes that have taken place in teaching patterns and study patterns over time, over that time, warrants a different outcome than what has occurred before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I'm not sure that I'm qualified to answer that question, but I would say this is a federal law requirement, and that hasn't changed over the years. In order for Oregon to be consistent and in conformity with federal law, it would be the federal law that would have to change.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. Jerry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Donnelly. I'm the Director of Human Resources at Portland Community College, and you've heard from some of my peers or coworkers at the institution this morning. I'm not going to attempt to address everything that they've raised, but I did want to talk about, I guess I'll start with 3118, which is the bill on the report that originated in 2557. I was part of the task team that Ms. Smith referred to that the college has pulled together to try to work on getting getting that report to be more consistent. And I will say that it is a challenge. Each of the 17 institutions report things differently. We have different collective bargaining agreements. Some of the colleges don't actually have all of these employees in collective bargaining units. So there are a wide range of differences. There are differences in the type of or the way compensation is done for different types of courses at the colleges. So there are a great number of variables that go into the employment situation in the community colleges, which makes it particularly tough to try to do an apples-to-apples kind of comparison. And I think that that Ms. Smith's characterization that we've made some progress in the discussions on that is accurate. Representative Dembrough and I have actually had a personal conversation about a way that we might be able to do this more effectively. I think we can get there on the compensation piece. On the enrollment information and sort of the ratio of instructors, I think that that piece was actually easier for us to get to, and the original report probably did meet that need. On the component of the bill which addresses the issue about student access during out-of-classroom hours, I have also talked with Representative Dembrough about me personally taking on a responsibility to talk with the HR directors from the other community colleges and to gather information about that so that it wouldn't be necessary to include that as a piece of the report. For example, at Portland Community College, we make available voicemail boxes as well as email accounts to all of our part-time instructors so that they have opportunities to interact with students without having to give out their home phone numbers, for example. And there are other institutions that I know have done similar kinds of things, though I don't at this point know comprehensively what the answer to that is. Are there questions for me on 3118? I mean,
Collins, Rep. Johnson, did you have a question?
Not on 3118.
Okay. Great.
Moving on then to 3320. I also won't attempt to address every issue here. I think the piece that Ms. Smith alluded to regarding the broadness of this bill is if you look at the language, for example, in line 21, it specifically says for purposes of this section, this subsection, a part-time or full-time instructor at a state institution. Going on without reading all the rest of it. So it does include full-time instructors. Representative Dembrough's characterization of full-time faculty is for the most part correct, that they tend to work a fall, winter, spring schedule. And then if they work also in the summer, that's considered, we don't call it overtime, we call it fourth-term employment. They are paid separately for that, and how they are paid depends on whether they are teaching one course or a full load for the summer, at least at Portland Community College. That may vary at other institutions. I'm not sure exactly how all the other institutions are handling that. Collective bargaining agreement we have for faculty does provide for full-time faculty to have a schedule other than a fall, winter, spring schedule, and it might be a fall, spring, summer schedule, in which case this would the unworked term then would be winter. There are possible variations on this in which a full-time instructor might in 1 year work a summer term, but in the following year revert to a schedule that would put them back on a fall, winter, spring schedule, and it then opens the door of whether they would be eligible for unemployment benefits the following summer because of the way the language here is worded. So I think there are some pieces that that in the detail that would need to be wordsmithed to correct the broadness of this if it were to only address the specific issues that have been raised with part-timers. I would also note that in line 19 it simply says a college instructor who has worked in the previous summer. It doesn't talk about part-time instructors specifically.
Yes. And colleagues, this was essentially what we might call placeholder language in these in this bill in its current form. It's not where we would want it to go. Yes, Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just assumed good colleague to the right here would be next. So I guess I'm going to drill down a little bit more on this issue of contracts. I've voted on a lot of K-12 employee contracts, and it's about days, and it's very precise, and there's really no gray area. I'm not yet understanding, so help me catch up with how the world of community colleges work, and universities, I guess we're talking about also. That contract, is there specified, I wouldn't think days, it would be terms. I'm trying to get at what stipulates the agreement, the contractual agreement, and maybe I just didn't catch it last time when I asked this. I didn't hear that there was a contract that stipulated that. I'm just trying to get that nailed down so I'm clear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, I can only speak specifically about PCC, though I've been at this a while and I have talked with the other HR directors, so I have a sense of how theirs work. But in brief, full-time faculty are hired on a annualized basis. They do work a 9-month year typically. You might fudge it to say it's a 10-month year, depending on how the terms actually fall. But their pay is then, their annual contract is for that time period, their annual salary is paid out over a 12-month period so that they continue to be paid and receive benefits during the full year. For part-time faculty, and this is one of those areas where it would vary by college exactly how they've articulated this, at PCC, our collective bargaining language specifies that part-time faculty are hired on a term-by-term basis. And in terms of the contract that you might be thinking of in a K through 12 kind of setting for a teacher, the college does not issue individual employment contracts on that kind of a term-by-term basis. So the individual's employment can be in any one of the four terms. It might only be one of those four terms, or it might be all four of those terms. Is that helpful?
You nailed it. You clearly answered my question. Thank you very much.
Yes. Let me just add, I know you have a question. Mm-hmm. No? Okay. If a part-timer were to lose their classes during the fall or winter or spring, they would be eligible for unemployment, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, and as I read the statute, that appears to be the case because it's not defined as being between the academic years.
Right. So, and if they lose their class during the summer, then they're not eligible.
Correct.
So it's really that we have this anomaly in the law, and that's what's causing this discussion. Further questions?
Yeah, I've got some. Write something down. You just come up with another thought.
I'll just ask it
while I've got it out here. As we talked about drop classes, is it more typical to find or have drop classes in the summer than the other terms of the year?
Mr.
Are you
Chairman,
more apt to find
Johnson,
classes that get dropped in the summer? And I guess I'll just tell you where my head is. As the perhaps there are a lot more activities in the summer, obviously. I mean, if I'm living in Hood River and I've got the option to take a course at Columbia Gorge Community College, you know, that might sound like a great offering, but you know what? The windsurfing's terrific, you know, and I might be tempted to get out there on the river and rig up and go rather than that other course, you know. So is it true? I'm just asking, is it possible true that you may find more drop classes as a rule during that summer term than the other terms of the year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, are you asking about drop classes from the perspective of the student or drop from
to,
the...
Not enough the, students to merit the staff person to teach the class.
I honestly don't know that I could answer that with any specificity. I don't know that it's actually true. I think that it may actually be the contrary. The tendency, I believe, of students who enroll in summer term classes is that they are intent on completing a particular interest of theirs or a degree as quickly as they can. And I think the reality, particularly as we have faced this enrollment surge in the last few years at the colleges, is that we are offering and filling, at this point, as many courses as we can offer. But I believe there may come a point, as the economy turns around, that we will see us get back to a point, which we were several years ago, where we would plan classes and plan a number of sections in every discipline based on expected enrollment and then not necessarily hit that enrollment target. Whether the classes are canceled or not sort of depends on a number of factors that are evaluated by the deans at that time to make decisions about whether to run the class with a low enrollment or to cancel it.
And I was just having that conversation with Frank Toda, our community college president, over the weekend, where based on the amount of dollars that we, this body, gives to the community colleges, they're still trying to make decisions about what kind of courses they're going to be able to offer, because there's a direct cause-effect relationship there. So I understand what some of those factors are. The other question I wanted to go into, though, was, is your college, and would you say most community colleges, are self-insured in regards to unemployment insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, we are. Self-insured may not be, I'm not sure that's the term for it, but we are a direct reimbursing employer. So,
if you're like our school district, for instance, when we have to do a reduction in force for budgetary reasons, that's not without cost to the district. I mean, the cost can be to the district as much as $25,000 a year in those unemployment benefits that are paid to that employee who is RIFed. So I would guess there is also then a correlating cost to the community colleges for unemployment benefits that would be payable to any employees during this period of time we're talking about as well. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Hoyle.
So in traditional unemployment insurance, we have sort of the unemployment trust fund where we put money aside for unemployment. You said you do direct reimbursement. Do you also have money put aside for that? Would this cause you to have to increase that balance or that fund, or but do you specifically have a fund to cover those situations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, I'm driving down here, I was thinking I should have called financial services to find out how much our annual reserve for unemployment benefits is. We do that. I do not know what the amount is. I do know that over the last 2 years, I've had more than one conversation with our Associate Vice President of Finance about her concern about how far we've overrun what we have budgeted in the last few years. And that's even without this being in place.
So and then you're going to do so. Your understanding, your experience is that the classes that you schedule classes according to the need, be it windsurfing season or ski season or fabulous fall bike season, whatever it be, but you schedule to the student need, and certainly from the talks that I've had with our school districts, with our community colleges, I mean, as you said, there is just much more demand, and almost like because students can't take classes in the fall or spring because they just can't fit into the classes, they're having to go to summer courses that they may not have planned to attend. So I know that in Lane that's been the experience as well. But normally, wouldn't you forecast your classes according to your anticipated need based on your historical projections in the non-recession time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoyle, I'll admit I'm not an expert on exactly how we do that projection, but in concept, yes, we do that.
Mm-hmm. And if I can just butt in, you know, going back to my days as a department chair, that is the methodology that we use. Sometimes we take chances on, you know, new programs or new courses, and sometimes those don't work out. But, you know, generally they do. And so, you know, I think there's an effort to try to minimize the number of sections that get dropped, because it's very... it's not only disturbing to the employee, obviously, it can be very disturbing for the student, who has to then try to find another course after the fact. It's very difficult. Well, thank you both for coming, and I would again echo the remarks that I think we're making progress on coming to consensus on the reporting piece. So, my sense is we're going to get there. So, thank you. Finally, I'd call up Emma Calloway to give us a student perspective on this issue. Emma, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's nice to see all of you again. For the record, my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and I just wanted to share a few of our thoughts around House Bill 3118. So, hello, co-chairs, Representative Dembro and Johnson. We have not taken an official stance on 3118, but I did want to share our appreciation for the merits in the bill. That's kind of the extent to which I can testify on it at this time. We definitely appreciate that access to faculty be something that's considered in 3118, and we think that that's probably one of the most important things to continue to report on as we're trying to reach 40-40-20, and as we are moving towards trying to graduate more and more Oregonians and making sure that we're maintaining quality. So it's very important to the Oregon Student Association that we often come before you and talk about budgets, and we talk about helping more and more students find access to our Oregon public schools, but we also want to maintain that important piece, which is quality. And we believe that an important factor in that is face-to-face time with our educators. Some of our students have asked that I share with you that they are waiting in lines of 1, 2, and 3 hours to meet with faculty during office hours. And that's a considerable amount of time when office hours usually only last about 2 hours. And so very often you will wait the entire period and never have the opportunity to meet with your faculty, regardless of whether they're part-time or full-time. And that's true at our community colleges, that's true at our universities, and it's because students are realizing that when they want to have success in the classroom, they need more one-on-one time. Our tutoring centers are filled to the brim at our universities and our community colleges because students are realizing that they need more help in order to get through rigorous course loads and taking 4 and 5 classes at a time and also working part-time. The majority of our students do work part-time. That means that they're needing more and more assistance. That's pretty much the extent of what I wanted to share with you today, but I will take any questions and also just remind you that the Oregon Student Association does appreciate any bill that does try to maintain quality or at least report back on the quality of our education and access to our faculty. So I won't echo the myriad of comments that were already made today, but we very much appreciate the time to testify.
Thank you, Emma. Any questions for Emma? It's always great to see you guys.
Great.
Not to see you, but to hear your insightful comments.
Thank you very much.
Well,
the public hearing.
I think that is it then for our public hearings on both House Bill 3320 and 3118. Close that. And is that anything for the good of the order, committee? We'll be back Thursday. We've got a few work sessions to cover. We're still trying to put together our schedule for next week, which could have some stuff relating to OUS material. We'll find out about that. We'll definitely have a hearing next following Thursday with the U of O folks, I believe. So that's kind of what we know coming up right now. So with that,
thanks for sitting there to adjourn.
With that, we will adjourn our